Radio with your host Ted Marr, broadcasting live tonight from the beautiful Backing Sea Blue Festival Italian Village, late on this warm summer night in the mountains near Pisa in northern Italy. I'm calling back Scott from Italy for today's program, which is being rebroadcast studio KKNW at 11:50 a.m. in Billington, Washington, outside Seattle, Washington, in the United States. The purpose of having this program was to raise to make this world a much better and much happier place. Hold on, we're getting a little bit of static. Let me try something. Hello, friends, and welcome to Out of This World Radio with your host, Ted Marr, broadcasting live today from a small town village late on this warm summer night in the mountains of Northern Italy. I'm calling back Scott from Italy. The program is being broadcast from the studios of KKNW here in Milton, Washington, just outside Seattle, Washington. The purpose of this program is to raise consciousness and make this world a much better and happier place. And I know that with everyone's help, we can and will make this world a better place. I want to thank everyone in Seattle around the world for your support in making Out of This World Radio one of the most popular talk shows in the Seattle area and the fastest growing metaphysical radio program in the world for listeners in over 70 countries. Today's show will be really Out of This World because during the first hour from 2 p.m. to 3 p.m., we'll be interviewing Dr. Stephen A. Schwartz, who's author of a wonderful book entitled The Eight Laws of Change. He's an incredibly interesting person. He's with me here at the interview. We're both attending a wonderful conference called the Infinite Consciousness Conscious, hosted by Professor Irvin Laszlo and the Laszlo Institute here in Italy, with some of the world's most interesting, fascinating doctors, scientists, and spiritual people. For more information, please see their website at www.laszloinstitute.com. During the second hour from 3 p.m. to 4 p.m., I'll be interviewing Courtney Brown, who's director of the Farsight Institute in Georgia. Courtney's been on my program before. He employs remote viewers in his nonprofit work with the Farsight Institute, and we will be discussing the John F. Kennedy assassination today, as well as some current events. I'm so honored to have both Dr. Schwartz and Courtney on my show today, which I guarantee will be really out of this world. Before I go on to my wonderful guests, Out of This World Radio is a nonprofit program supported entirely by donations. And for those who'd like to donate, please go to the donate button at the upper right-hand corner of the program webpage at www.outofthisworld1150.com and just click on it. I want to thank everyone for their donations and support, especially Marco in Finland, Judith in California, Marie and Alan in Camilla Island, Robert and Julia and Louise in Bellevue, Randy and Jessica in Mercer Island, Darren in Olympia, Corey in Kent, and everyone around the world who've helped me raise consciousness to make this planet a better place. I'd like to thank the many sponsors of this show, including Crystal and of the Crystal Voyage Bookstore in Tacoma, Orion Tech Computers in Bend, Oregon, the Tokeland Hotel in Tokeland, Washington. We're also looking for sponsors and advertisers for the show. Any advertising on the program will have a worldwide audience in over 70 countries for your goods and services. And I know that with everyone's help, we can and will make this planet a much better and happier place. I'd also like to thank the many wonderful sponsors of this show, including my dear friend Carol, who's been designing my website and providing wonderful support, my friends Michiko Hayashi, as well as Hiro Emoto, Mrs. Emoto, and Dr. Yasu Nemoto of the Emoto Peace Project and Emoto Office in Tokyo, Japan, my friends in the Galactic Alliance who've been supporting my show, my angelic and earthly family, and as well as my wonderful sound engineer, Eric, and my station manager, Eric Crema, without whose help and support this program would not be possible. I've started a new spiritual mentoring program. I've been in touch with the other side for 22 years, and my accuracy rate for readings is very high. If you'd like to get in touch with contacting friends and family on the other side who've passed on or to determine or help determine your career choices and relationships, please call me. I'd be happy to help you in any way I can. My phone number in the United States is 509-750-9793, or you can send me an email to outofthisworld1150@gmail.com. The program is supported entirely by donations, and if you'd like to donate, please go to our website at www.outofthisworld1150.com and just click on the PayPal link, or you can send your donations to me at Ted Marr at 1347 Deerbrush Drive, Southeast, Olympia, Washington, 98513 in the United States. I want to thank everyone who came to my Galactic Wisdom Conference last night. It was really, really a big success. We'll be having another one on March 10, 11, and 12, 2017. And during last month's conference, we had nearly a dozen different galactic spacecraft show up to protect us. And they said they'll be making another appearance at my conference next year. Beginning on August 8th, next month, 2016, Out of This World Television will start broadcasting three times a week on Comcast Channel 22 here in Puget Sound, Seattle. And I will post those times when the show will air on my website next week. There will be 10 episodes with some pretty incredible people, including Michiko Hayashi, Scott Lemriel, Billy Faye Woodard, and Zora of the Inner Earth, and many, many others. You'll also be able to watch Out of This World television on both YouTube and on Vimeo under Ted Maher, Out of This World television. Some of the episodes are now on both YouTube and Vimeo, and by this time next week, all of them should be up on the web to watch. I wanted to tell you some wonderful events and conferences which will be coming up. On Saturday, July 30th, there will be the 5th Annual Midsummer Healing and Intuitive Arts Fair at the Silverdale Beach Hotel at 3073 Northwest Buckland Road, Hill Road in Silverdale, Washington, from 12 noon to 8 p.m. I'll be there, as well as my dear friends Teresa Carroll and Carolyn White, are really wonderful, talented healers and psychic readers, and I hope you can come too. For more information, please go to their website at www.midsummerhealing.info, or you can email Kelly at kellyosevents@gmail.com or call her at 206-713-3700. From August 12th to the 21st, there will be a wonderful spiritual conference sponsored by Marilyn Rosner and the IIHS Institute in Montreal, Canada. I'll be coming, as well as Michiko Hayashi, the Moto Peace Project, and I hope you can come. For more information, please see their website at www.iiihs.org. Then from August 19th to the 21st, there will be another wonderful conference called the Peace and Light Conference in the Dominican Republic. This is an incredible opportunity to meet some of the world's most famous and interesting spiritual people, including a gentleman named Brazzo, who can actually heal people with his eyes. For more information, please see their website at www.paxluxmundi.com. On September 17th, there will be another Cosmic Awareness Fair in Olympia at the Washington RV Park and Events Center at 9101 Stolichnam Road with some incredibly talented psychics and aura healers. I'll be there, and as well as some wonderful healers, including Carolyn White. The event's free, and I hope you can come. From October 18th through November 5th, 2016, I'm organizing a U.S. West Coast tour by the wonderful Michiko Hayashi of the Moto Peace Project in Tokyo. She'll be coming into Los Angeles and giving a series of presentations in Los Angeles, San Francisco, Mount Shasta, Portland, Oregon, Olympia, Tacoma, Seattle, Washington, and Vancouver, Canada. It'll be on messages from water and the wonderful work of Dr. Masaru Emoto. One of the events will be on October 23rd, in which Michiko will be giving a very presentation at Stewart Hot Springs next to Mount Shasta, and proceeds from her talk will benefit the wonderful Moto Peace Project, which helps children around the world understand love and gratitude to create a much better and happier place. For more information, please email me at outofthisworld1150@gmail.com, or please call me on my cell at 509-750-9793. And with that, I'd like to go on to my first wonderful guest, Dr. Stephen Schwartz. Stephen, hi. Welcome to the program.
How are you? It's a pleasure to be here.
Wonderful, Stephen. I'd like to tell my listeners a little bit about his background. He's a distinguished consulting faculty at Saybrook University and a research associate of the Cognitive Sciences Laboratory at Laboratories for Fundamental Research. He's a columnist for the journal Explore and the editor of a daily web publication, SchwartzReport.net, in which he covers trends that are affecting the future. He also writes regularly for the Huffington Post. For 40 years, Dr. Schwartz has been studying the nature of consciousness. He's the author of more than 130 technical reports and papers. In addition to experimental studies, he's written numerous magazine articles for the Smithsonian, Omni, American History, American Heritage, the Washington Post, the New York Times, as well as other newspapers and magazines. He's produced and written a number of television documentaries, and he's written four books: The Secret Vaults of Time, The Alexandria Project, Mind Rover, Opening to the Infinite, and his latest, The Eight Laws of Change. Stephen, I have to ask you, how did you ever get interested in this particular field?
Well, when I was 24, I woke up. And I had a series of experiences that the materialist worldview that I held at that time simply couldn't explain. So I went looking for answers. And the door that I eventually went through was the Edgar Cayce material. So I spent 4 years reading all of the Edgar Cayce readings. There are about 15,000 of them.
Oh, my God.
And reading most of the New Thought leaders, Rudolf Steiner, Gurdjieff, Uspensky, Ernest Holmes, Charles Fillmore, and all of the parapsychological literature, at least everything that was in the libraries that I could get access to. Mm-hmm. And in 1968, I started doing experiments. And what I, in those days, called distant viewing, today we call it remote viewing, which is, let me acknowledge, a terrible term, because it has nothing to do with remoteness and it has nothing to do with viewing. But it was a term coined by the late Ingo Swann, a New York artist, back in the early 70s. And I was one of a small group of people, the Russ Targ, Hal Puthoff, Ed May, at SRI Institute, the PEAR Lab, the Princeton Engineering Anomalies Research Group at Princeton University. My particular interest from the beginning was to design experiments that simply couldn't be explained in any other way but the use of what we came to call non-local consciousness. That is, the idea that not all consciousness is physiologically based. And my particular area of interest was in archaeology, and I used it to find a whole raft of things: Cleopatra's palace, Mark Antony's palace, the Lighthouse of Pharos, one of the seven wonders of the ancient world, one of the caravels of Christopher Columbus, the American brig Leander. We got into crime solving as well. These experiments were all triple blind. That is, at the time that we were obtaining the information, nobody in the world knew the answer. So there was no possibility that you could have read up on it in a book or that you could have heard somebody talking about it. These were all things that everybody acknowledged had existed in the past, mm-hmm. but nobody knew where they were. Mm-hmm. And so the question was, could people accurately describe the location? And could they describe not just the location, but specific and very detailed reconstructions of the materials that we would find if at that location? For 20 years, I ran what was called the Mobius Laboratory in mm-hmm. Los Angeles, and we did these experiments and expeditions all over the world.
That's incredible. That's just amazing to share that kind of information. I have to ask you this question. I have lots of questions to ask you, and I'm so happy that you could come on today, Dr. Schwartz.
Okay.
But have you gone to the dark side of the moon? Have you visited planets outside of this one in your exploration?
I haven't, because I don't do experiments that I can't test objectively and get a verifiable information. However, I would say this. Ingo Swann and Harold Sherman, Harold was a very well-known writer and practitioner of non-local tasks back in the 40s and 50s and 60s, mm-hmm. early 70s, he's gone now. He and Ingo Swann did a series of experiments going to Mars, Mercury, and Jupiter. And they described in great detail these planets prior to the arrival of the space probes that NASA had sent out. Wow. They did it because they knew that NASA was sending space probes out, and therefore there would be objectively verifiable information. Mm-hmm. And Ingo wrote it all up in a book called To Kiss Earth Goodbye. Mm-hmm. And the information that they provided turned out to be very substantially accurate.
That's incredible. Now, with these capabilities, is it possible to go into the future as well? And if so, were you able to look at the United States or the world from a future point in time?
Yes, I've been running an experiment since 1978, asking people to remote view the same date in the year 2050.
That's neat.
And I've now had about 4,000 people do it. Mm-hmm. And I originally got into it because I had been in the government and in a part of a senior staff. And I had gotten regular briefings about what the military and the intelligence community thought about the what's going to happen in the future. And in those days, this is 1978, this is the height of the Cold War, and we were concerned that we were going to blow ourselves up.
Sure.
I mean, and people, serious people, seriously thought that. Mm-hmm. And I thought, well, I'll use this ability, this remote viewing, to see what the world looks like. And I didn't want to get too far in advance, mm-hmm. because if you get too far out, you can't understand what they're saying. Mm-hmm. To give you an example, Jules Verne, after he wrote 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea, his editor said to him, come on, Jules, write something else. And he said, well, I have this novel. And the editor said, well, send it to me. So he sent it to him. It was called Paris in the Future. It was based mm-hmm. about Paris in the 1960s. Mm-hmm. This was being written in the late 1850s. And he wrote this book, sent it to his editor. It described Paris as being a city with large corporations mm-hmm. where people didn't have horses anymore, but they drove around in internal combustion machines.
Oh.
They transmitted business correspondence via facsimile machines, that women made up a large part of the workforce, and that the city's dominant symbol was a large metal fretwork tower. The Eiffel Tower had been built, never even thought about. That's really incredible. And he, wrote the novel, he sent it in to his editor, and his editor wrote it back, and he said, Jules, both your editor and your friend, I advise you to destroy this, or at least put it away and never publish it, because if you were to do so, it's so absurd that it would destroy your reputation. So Verne actually did that. He didn't publish the book. He put it in his sheet, locked it up, forgot about it. And in the, more than 100 years later, an heir of his, who had inherited a farm that had once been Verne's, was going through this property that he had inherited, and under an old table in a barn, he saw this safe. And he said to the farmer who farmed the land, what's in the safe? And the farmer said, I don't know. It's never been opened in my lifetime or my father's lifetime.
Huh.
And so the heir had a locksmith come out and break the safe open. And in it, they found the manuscript and the correspondence about between the editor and Verne himself, which is why I can tell this story.
Sure.
And of course, everything that he had predicted was true. The Eiffel Tower, facsimile machines, automobiles, corporations being the dominant business form. None of that existed when he wrote the book. Mm-hmm. So the problem was that what he was saying was so preposterous that it was incomprehensible. And if you think about it, if you were in the 18th century and you were looking at the 20th century and somebody said to you, a remote viewer said to you, well, there's this kind of thing that looks sort of like a picture, and you have, it stands on a stand, and you can turn it on, and you can see pictures and films, pictures of people dancing, and you can see stories of the past and the future. I mean, what would you make of that?
Right.
So if you go too far in the future, you can't understand what people are saying. And I chose 2050 because I figured, based on the rate of technological development, that I could probably still understand what they were saying. And to my surprise, what they told me was not at all what I expected.
What kinds of things have people come up with for 2050? I'm really interested to know.
Well, first of all, they told me that the Soviet Union was going to disappear.
Okay.
And I couldn't make any sense out of that at all. I mean, at the time that they were giving these readings, doing these remote viewing sessions, the idea that the Soviet Union would disappear was preposterous. We were in a great bipolar world. And, of course, in 1991, the Soviet Union disappeared. So I didn't even understand what to make of that. Another thing that they told me, because I asked them not only about 2050, but I said, well, what happened to us to that point?
Sure.
And in one case, a group of them said to me, these are people speaking independently. I said, oh, well, then the world, if the Soviet Union disappears, well, then the world would be much safer. And they said, oh, no, the world looks more dangerous. And I said, why would the world be more dangerous? And they said, because of terrorism. And I said, what else? And they said, well, there are going to be a series of epidemics. And I said, really? What kind of epidemics? And they said, well, the first one, this was, these people started talking about this in 78, 79. They said, well, the first one's coming very quickly. It's a blood disease that's crossed over from primates in Africa, and it's going to go into humans, and it's going to kill millions of people. And so I took it to a friend of mine who was then the deputy director of the National Institutes of Health, and said to him, you know anything about the blood disease that's coming in the next few years that crossed over from primates and got into humans, and it's going to kill millions of people? I mean, do you know anything about that? And they said, no, we don't know anything about it. And in 1981, the first case showed up in the United States, and nobody knows the rest of the story. So the story that they tell is quite different than the sort of high-tech, mechanistic world that you see in most movies.
Huh, interesting. What do they in 2015? Has the planet been largely cleaned up? Is much pollution? Do people live in harmony? Is there? Do they see conflict among peoples?
No. In 2050, well, the other thing they started telling me about was that there was going to be massive catastrophic change in the climate.
I see.
And I couldn't make any sense of that.
Sure.
And I took it around to scientists. You know, I'm a scientist. I knew a lot of scientists. I took it around to people and said, is there any reason why there would be catastrophic climate change? And everybody said to me, no, what are you talking about? And then I read the first paper that I read was in 1991. It was about an ice coring paper. And that was the first time that I knew anything about climate change.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. Did they say the planet would be a lot warmer then? What did they say in terms of climate? Changing climate, true, but what would the planet be like then?
Well, I was so dumbfounded that I have to confess to you that I didn't ask everybody all the questions that I might have. So I didn't ask them, does it get warmer? What they did tell me was that the sea had risen a great deal, and that many people had left the cities and that were living in smaller communities. And they also said that there were great droughts that had caused migrations. And of course, all of this we now know is going to happen. But, you know, the world that they described was this world in which there had been massive change, sea rise, migrations, movements into smaller communities, intentional communities, and people didn't travel very much because the airplanes didn't fly much because there was some sort of environmental problem, and I think that's probably going to be true.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, well, then how do people get around? How do they communicate? And they said, oh, well, through virtual, not virtual, that's my word. They said, well, you put on this apparatus and it gives you all your senses, experience it, and you travel sort of electronically in some way. This is before the internet.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, really? You know, what do you mean? And well, you put this stuff on and then you can go to a meeting in another place or even in some imaginary place. And all of your senses are there, but the sort of locus of your awareness is in this sort of avatar figure that you're talking about. And of course, I couldn't make any sense out of that either.
Interesting. Wow.
But I suspect it's all going to happen. They described for me that medicine had collapsed in some way that they couldn't quite understand. And of course, we're facing now the collapse of antibiotic medicine. And that, I would say, typically the way these sessions would go is I would say, okay, you are now in the same date in the year 2050. You're standing, your life size, you're standing in front of the place where you spend the night. And you'll note how I frame that. I don't say your home.
Right.
Because you don't want any presuppositions. So
sure.
I just said, I want you to go to the place where you spend the night.
Sure.
And I want you to go into that space and then now describe for me what you see. And they would describe it. And then I would say, now I want you to go to the place where you spend most of your waking hours. And people would describe that. And I would say, now I want you to go to some place where there is where you buy something. And how does that happen? And they would say to me, well, it's funny. It's not money anymore. It's like a picture of your eye or your thumbprint. Hmm. And of course, all of that is where we're headed.
Right.
So the accuracy level of the future viewings is pretty close to the accuracy we see in the archaeological work. That is, we expect to have 75 to 85% of the information be evaluated mm-hmm. as correct or partially correct.
Right. For those who are just tuning in, this is Out of This World Radio with your host, Ted Marr, broadcasting actually tonight from Pisa, Italy, through the and then rebroadcast through 1150 AM on KKNW in Bellevue, Washington, just outside Seattle in the United States. There's so many questions to ask you, and we haven't even gotten to your wonderful book, The Eight Laws of Change, Stephen, but I have to ask you, what about relations with any extraterrestrial life? Did they same thing about any kind of contact with ETs?
No, people always ask me that question, but no, nobody ever said anything about that.
Okay.
That doesn't mean it doesn't happen. But they didn't say anything about it.
Mm-hmm.
They talked about the loss of biodiversity. I mean, the questions that I was asking was, you know, what is your life like? Where do you go to if you need to get medical treatment? Where do you go? Where do people go to get education? Very concrete kind of things for which I could get evidence eventually in time that could be objectively verified.
I have a very important question to ask, Stephen, and I'm sure you've thought about it too. This was 1978 when you were asking these questions. When you started asking them. And when you ask these kinds of questions about the year 2050 in the future, does that assume that there's not going to be any, that people are not going to make better changes in their choices about protecting the planet, about not polluting, about living in harmony, about cleaning up the planet, or just things, all the free will choices that we made up so far, if you extrapolate all those choices into the future, this is the kind of future we can expect without people making better choices to make a better planet?
You know, they don't speak in that way, but I would say to you, it seems pretty clear to me. I'm now doing an analysis of this data. And so I'm going to, I will know a great deal more about it in a couple of months, because as I say, I'm just beginning a very extensive analysis of the data. I've just given you some of the highlights, but there's much more detail. I would say, I've been asking myself that question. I would say to you that there is a growing and continuing schism between two worldviews. One of the worldviews is pretty much what we have today, which is profit, greed, all of that. But there is another part, it appears, where at least a large segment of the population has moved into a different mindset, because the remote viewers talk about these volitional communities, mm-hmm. where people go and work and are very much in a cooperative, collective kind of attitude.
This leads into my next question. Stephen, you've written some wonderful books, including one most recently called The Eight Laws of Change. And if I got this from a little bit of a description about the book, you've studied the different successful social transformations, and you found there's three different ways to create social change. The first is the advancement of technology and science. The second is almost always coercive and violent, and for those reasons not long lasting. And the third, which is the most successful, is enduring is the one brought about by something so subtle it's not often taken seriously, small individual choices based on integrity and shared intention. And given the fact that the planet is warming up, and given the fact that we do have a lot of problems, you look at the different stories of different individuals who actually changed history, such as Martin Luther King Jr., Benjamin Franklin, Mother Teresa, Mahatma Gandhi, detailing how they implemented the strategies and tactics of the Eight Laws to achieve their success. And that's the reason why I have my radio program, among other reasons, is because I do want to help make this planet a better place. Could you go over those Eight Laws of Success? I know my listeners would love to hear about your book.
Well, I wrote this book very specifically for people who are interested in creating compassionate, life-affirming, wellness-oriented change. Because I publish a daily web publication called SchwartzReport.net. And so I track these trends. I've been doing it for several decades now. And I have become more and more alarmed with the state of not only the country, but of the world. Mm-hmm. The loss of biodiversity, climate change, the sea rise, drought, migrations. I mean, all the things that we're now seeing, the rise of terrorism, like this dreadful thing that's just happened in Nice. So I spent 16 years looking at about 200 social transformations, trying to see if there were any commonalities about the successful ones, because not all of them succeed. And I wanted to see the ones that did succeed, if there was some commonality across all of them. And, you know, I thought it was going to be stuff like you have to be good at fundraising, or you have to know how to make an organizational chart, things like that. Because that's sort of, you'd think, well, if you're going to have an organization, you need to know all that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And it turned out that what these 200 plus social transformations, the successful ones, had in common were these eight patterns of behavior and attitudes, really. It's as much attitude as anything else. And I was interested in giving people a manual of how to create social change, mm-hmm. not theoretically or speculatively or in political terms or some kind of partisan point of view. I didn't care about any of that. What I care about, and the research that I also do in addition to the consciousness research, although they're actually very closely related, is I look at trends that are shaping the future.
Mm-hmm.
And I do so by looking at outcome data. If you do this, what happens?
Sure.
And so I'm constantly tracking things like infant mortality, maternal mortality, obesity, sexually transmitted disease rates, premarital pregnancy, divorce, obesity, incarceration, education level, that kind of stuff.
Sure.
And I look at, if you put in this kind of social policy, well, what happens?
Right.
And the beautiful thing is, you know, Justice Brandeis, in a decision that he wrote in 1932, said, you know, you should think of the states as laboratories because they each can choose what they want to do, and the whole country doesn't have to do it.
Right.
And so I particularly look at interstate comparisons. You could look at Minnesota and Wisconsin, for instance, states that basically have the same heritage. They were really created as a result of Abraham Lincoln's signing the Homestead Act in 1864, and it resulted in large numbers of Lutheran Scandinavians, principally, coming out and homesteading in Wisconsin and Minnesota. And the two states have been first cousins from the very beginning. And for most of their history, they have been pretty much in tandem. But about 30 years ago, with the rise of theocratic rightism, they began diverging because Wisconsin elected a governor who was a theocratic rightist, and that's Wisconsin, and Minnesota is elected Mark Dayton, who's a social progressive, and you just look at the difference between the two states now, their economic situation, their educational situation, their social safety network. Wisconsin is in desperate shape. You could do the same thing by looking at Kansas and California. Mm-hmm. Sam Brownback in Kansas has practically destroyed his state along with the legislature.
Mm-hmm.
And Jerry Brown, who inherited a state in desperate trouble in California, with his legislature, has brought the state back, and it's gone from vast deficits to significant surpluses. So if you look across the country and you look at these various states and compare their social outcomes, mm-hmm. you can see that the choices that they make really do make a difference. And I began looking at these social outcomes, and also one of the things I discovered was that violent change only succeeds about 25% of the time, whereas nonviolent change succeeds about 75% of the time.
Hmm.
And equally important, violent change only lasts for a short while, and nonviolent change tends to be very enduring.
I know in the write-up you mentioned the example of Nazi Germany, which lasted about 1933, about 12 years, 10 years.
10 to 20 years.
10 to 20 years or so. Not a long time. The Soviet Union lasted for about 70 years. Those were violent, coercive regimes, which didn't last a long time. But
right.
the nonviolent ones, the United States has been around. We have our problems, sure. But we've been around for over 200 years.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, that's precisely the kind of thing I'm talking about. So I was very surprised at that.
Sure.
That violent change is really not a good social choice.
Mm-hmm.
It does not produce wellness. My view is the role of the state is to produce well-being.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And well-being for the entire population and the entire society, not just well-being for a few. And if you look at these changes, I mean, these laws let me frame it differently. What emerged out of this research, these 16 years of research, were these eight patterns. And all the social movements who employed these eight patterns succeeded. And the ones who didn't, even though their purposes might have been very good, didn't.
Wow. That's incredible. If I may, I'd love to go through some of these laws. We've got about 16 minutes left, Stephen. The first one is individuals individually and the groups collectively share a common intention.
Okay, that was the first pattern. Well, if you think about it, I mean, if you've ever been on a committee at a church or a school or in your work or in your neighborhood, you know, it's hard to get everybody on the same page to share the same intention. I mean, you
right.
can say, well, we all have the same goal,
right.
whatever the goal is.
Right.
But when you get down to the lick log, you find out that people don't have the same intention. They have quite
right.
different visions of
right.
what that goal looks like.
Right.
So the first thing is the individual individually and the group collectively must share a common intention.
Mm-hmm.
And the second one is, individuals in the group may have goals, but they cannot have cherished outcomes. Now, I got this sort of thing from the abolitionists, because they would say things like, slavery is a moral evil, and it must end. But I don't quite know how that's going to happen. All I know is I'm going to work to make it happen.
Mm-hmm.
The third law is individuals in the group must authentically accept that the goal that they... Wait a minute, let me think it through again. That the individuals must recognize that the goal may not happen in their lifetime. Mm-hmm. And again, I get this from the abolitionists, and particularly from the Quakers. Mm-hmm. The Quakers are one of the most interesting groups in the country. There is no other group that has been as successful at social transformation as the Quakers. Mm. If you go back all the way to the colonial period, even though there's so few Quakers that most people have never met one, mm-hmm. have no idea what they believe, mm-hmm. and will never meet one, but if you look at it, almost every major social transformational progressive change in the United States, abolition, women's rights, penal reform, public education, nuclear freeze, mm-hmm. the environmental movement, you discover that at the beginnings, there is this tiny group of Quakers who are the real drivers.
Interesting.
So, because they have figured these eight laws out and they use them all the time. Hmm. So another law is that the individuals in the group must accept that they may not get credit for what they're doing. Sure. And this is much harder for people to understand and accept than... you might imagine, because if you do something, you want to get credit for it. But again, I looked at the abolitionists and the others, and they would say, nobody will remember me or the role I've played, but I just feel morally it is my responsibility to try to end slavery.
Mm-hmm. Interesting.
So the fifth law is each person in the group, regardless of gender, religion, or race, or culture, must enjoy fundamental equality while the various roles in the hierarchy of the effort are respected. Now that, you think about that for a minute. We are high-order mammals, high-order primates. We organize in hierarchies. We're genetically predispositioned to that. Mm-hmm. But within that, there must also be the acceptance there is fundamental equality. You can't run everything on a consensus, and you can't run everything with everybody being the decision maker on every issue. Mm-hmm. Some people have got to do one task and others have got to do another. Now, if you look at some recent social transformational movements, you can see because they were never able to work that business of this fundamental equality and yet having a hierarchy, you have to have the Martin Luther Kings and the Mahatma Gandhis and the Mother Teresa's, whatever. You have to be, that's just the nature of the kind of beings we are. Mm-hmm. And so you have to figure that out. My personal view is that the Occupy movement failed because they could not bring forward a spokesman. And so there was never anyone that people coalesced around in the way that people coalesced around Martin Luther King. So the sixth law is that you must forswear violence in word, act, or thought. And that one for me is the hard one. Mm-hmm. Because if I see somebody doing something that I think is really morally repugnant, taking advantage of people, hurting people, exploiting people, I confess that often, not always, but often, my initial reaction is they need to get hurt back. Mm-hmm. And so you have to meditate on that and really work with it, because you have to make it real. Mm-hmm. You cannot just verbalize it. You have to be real. Mm-hmm. Another one is that the individuals in the group must make their personal lives consistent with their public postures. Mm-hmm. Well, this one, we all know endless stories of spiritual leaders who are professing their great morality, and then in the back room they're sexually abusing little boys and girls, or mm-hmm. buying cocaine or whatever it is. Mm-hmm. So your personal life and your public life have got to be the same. Mm-hmm. And the final one is that the individuals individually and the group collectively must always act from the beingness of integrity. Mm-hmm. That is, you must always make the compassionate, life-affirming choice. You must always be in integrity. And and I guess the final sort of the compilation of all of them is what I call the quotidian choice. Mm-hmm. And that is every day you make thousands or no, wait, make dozens of decisions. You know, the toothpaste you buy, the toilet paper you buy, the gas you buy, the how you address people, the cat food you buy, whatever.
Right.
We make thousands of these decisions through the course of a week.
Right.
And the key to the quotidian choice issue, which is the power. This is the great secret. Mm-hmm. I mean, if all of your listeners will do this, you can change the world.
Right.
I guarantee that if the people who are listening to this show will do this, they can change the world. Mm-hmm. Because people have. Mm-hmm. And that is every time you make a choice, be aware you're making a choice. Mm-hmm. Strangely enough, people are not aware that they're making choices. You know, you go into the market and you just buy stuff because that's what you've always bought. You right. don't ever think about it. Right. Is this company a good company? Mm-hmm. Do they pay their workers well? Right. Are they respectful of the planet? Do they exploit people? You know, that kind of thing.
Sure.
So first of all, be aware you're making choices. Mm-hmm. Second of the options that are available to you, always choose the option that is the most compassionate, life-affirming, and wellness-supportive of the options. Now, mm-hmm. none of the options may be great options. I mean, you may be in a situation where there is no great option, but inevitably one option will be better than the others. Mm-hmm. And you consistently choose that, and you tell 10 of your friends that that's what you're doing, mm-hmm. and you invite them to do it with you. Mm-hmm. And ask them to tell 10 of their friends. Well, just let's say that you have 10,000 listeners tonight. I mean, maybe you have 100,000 listeners, but we'll start with. Or let's just start with 1,000 listeners. You have many more, I know, but we'll just start with 1,000 because you'll see the math. Well, those 1,000 people do it, and they tell 10 people. Now we have 10,000. Now we have 100,000. Now we have 1,000,000.
That's right.
Now we have 10 million.
That's right.
Now we have 100 million.
That's right.
Well, the key to this is we know how many people you have to get change to commit themselves to change in order to make it the change happen, and that's 10%. So there are about 318 million people in the United States, and if we can get 31 million of those people to commit to this, right. we can make the country anything we want.
Absolutely. And, you know, as you so profoundly noted in your book, Stephen, and I want to thank you so much for coming on today. We're at a crossroads on this planet.
Absolutely.
And we can either be a change for the better or a change for the worse. And in your book, you ask, will you be an agent of change that produces wellness and a better planet, or will you not?
Well, you know, I mean, Ted, it really is. We're down to the lick log, as I said. Mm-hmm. If we don't make changes now, our children and our grandchildren will live in a world we won't even recognize. We would not even recognize.
We won't want to recognize.
And we would not want to recognize.
I
don't think it has really totally dawned on people how near the precipice we are and the need for compassionate, life-affirming change.
Right.
That we each become agents of change
right.
has never been greater. And right. just, I know we're coming to the end, and so I would just say this. There is no power in the world mm-hmm. greater than the collective shared intention and commitment of ordinary people.
I think we're all powerful spiritual beings, and we were meant to live together in harmony, and also not only to respect ourselves, but each other and also Mother Earth as well.
Absolutely. You know, part of our problem is we have this dominionist view of our relationship to the Earth. We think that we live on the earth and that it's our right to exploit the earth as we please. It's kind of like a bank account that an old aunt leaves you, when in fact we live in the earth. Mm-hmm. There's life miles below our feet and miles above our heads. We live in the Goldilocks zone on the surface. Mm-hmm. And we need to recognize that not only is the earth not something independent of us, but that in fact we live in a matrix of consciousness in which all life is interdependent and interconnected. And therefore, the choices that we make in relation to the earth harm not only ourselves, but all the beings on the earth. And we are at a place, we are at sort of the 11th hour and the 59th minute. And if everybody that hears this will acknowledge that it is their moral responsibility to support that which is compassionate and life-affirming and productive of wellness, we have a way out. And if we don't do that, we are doomed.
I had a conference last month called the Galactic Wisdom Conference, Stephen. And one of the people there, he was from what he called the Hollow Earth. And he told people that the most important force in the universe is love and respect. And he was saying the same thing you're saying, actually, which was really beautiful. The other thing, too, he always said to do is to always base your decisions on love and respect and think with your heart mind, through your heart.
That's right. I mean, you know, I mean, everything I'm saying, it's not that it's original to me. I didn't make these eight laws up. Mm-hmm. You know, this isn't something I made up. These are patterns of success. Mm-hmm. I wanted to give people a manual with the eight laws of change, this new book. I wanted to give them a manual that they could follow. So the book's in three parts. The first part is what it is, which is what we've been talking about, mm-hmm. and how to do it. The middle part is stories of people who've actually done it successfully. And the third part is all the neuro and social science that explains why it works. Mm-hmm. Because I'm a researcher and I like data, and so that's what I trust. We have to do this. There are many ways to do it. There are many ways to talk about it. There are many ways to contextualize it, but the core of it is we are interdependent and interconnected, and that we must support that which produces wellness.
Wonderful, Stephen. We've got a little less than 3 minutes left. And for those listening today, this is Out of This World Radio with your host, Ted Marr, actually broadcasting from Italy tonight. But the station, the program is being rebroadcasted on 1150 AM on KKNW in Seattle in the United States. And I want to thank everyone so much for listening to Dr. Schwartz today. He's an incredible man with a very important message. Dr. Schwartz, we've got about 2 minutes left. I want to give you the rest of the time. And I want you all, everyone, to stay tuned because we'll be having another remote viewer on Courtney Brown during our next hour. A fascinating man coming to us from the Farsight Institute in Georgia to talk about the JFK assassination. But I'd like to give you the rest of the time now, about 2 minutes, to please give some words of wisdom to my audience.
Well, I guess I would say to people, you are more than animated meat. You know, the materialist worldview is we're animated meat. Dead meat, no consciousness. Well, if you think about it for a minute and you look at the research, there are now 8 protocols in consciousness research, each of which independently has odds of better than 1 in a billion that it could be happening by chance. You look at the NDEs, the near-death experiences.
Right.
About 13 million Americans have had near-death experiences that they have reported. The actual number is much higher, but these are people who've actually reported it to doctors or somebody. If you consider that, and then you look at the reincarnation research, what you come away with is the continuity of consciousness. That is, you know, Max Planck gave an interview in 1931 to the Observer newspaper in England, in London, and they asked him, he's the father of quantum mechanics, and they said to him, oh, Professor Planck, what have you learned in all your years? And he said, what I have learned is that consciousness is fundamental and causal. Space-time is a manifestation of consciousness. We existed before we were born. We will exist after we are gone, and we will be back again. And once you look at the world in that way, you realize how important wellness is.
Thank you so much, Dr. Schwartz, for coming in on today. It's a wonderful interview. And please stay tuned, my friends, for our next interview with Courtney Brown from the Farsight Institute. Thank you so much, everyone. Please stay tuned.